It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll feature the Madison instrumental rock band El Valiente.
But first, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup.
The Wisconsin State Patrol made headlines this week when it announced it would take back pay raises for state troopers who are owed overtime.
Governor Walker was also in the news after he made some comments about securing the border with Canada and then tied anti-police sentiment to President Obama.
The state legislature also got some attention with two bills aimed at defunding Planned Parenthood of federal funding that comes through the state of Wisconsin.
Joining us now for the latest on all these stories is Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So earlier this week, the State Highway Patrol announced it would be cutting down on the size of Scott Walker's security team and taking back a raise that was also given to them, rescinding that raise. What led to the changes?
So for a number of years, going back before Scott Walker was governor, the team that has protected the governor round the clock has in most cases not received overtime. And there appears to have been a complaint to the U.S. Department of Labor sometime this year. We don't know the details of what prompted this, but the Department of Labor looked into the issue and has concluded that these troopers are owed overtime. So now the state has to go back and calculate for the last 2 years how much money is owed. And as a result of that, they're making some changes to save money in the future.
And do we know how that could change the governor's protection and also the lieutenant governor, because she also receives security from the same group?
As does the governor's wife and, you know, visiting governors or other dignitaries. We don't know. They won't tell us, they say for security reasons, exactly what they're going to do. But we do know that the unit, which is 10 members now, will shrink to 5, and they will be bringing in, other troopers from throughout the state patrol to sort of help on a to augment what the dignitary protection unit does. So what we don't know is, does this mean some officials are going to get less coverage, or if we're just going to have a bigger pool of people? The idea, though, will be to have more of the time that troopers are working paid at straight time during their regular 40-hour-a-week shift rather than on overtime.
And are the taxpayers then going to be accountable for that overtime that's due?
Every penny of it.
And how much?
We don't know
how
much. It looks like it'll be around $1 million. We don't know exactly yet.
So how does that happen, that's such a million-dollar price tag could accrue like that and not be flagged until now?
Well, I mean, the state didn't think that it had to pay them this money. In the past, they thought they could just sort of treat them as salaried employees. They put in some very long hours. It's not unusual for them to work 60 or 80-hour weeks when, you know, the governor travels a lot, particularly now he's traveling a lot as he runs for president. If they go out of state, if they go to Europe, say, on a trade mission, they're with him all this time, and they would be, if not working every minute of it, they'd be on call or working a great portion of it. And so the state has said in the past that last year these officers together worked 8,200 hours of uncompensated time. Well, if you start calculating all of that at time and a half and you stretch it out for more than 2 years, it adds up pretty quick.
We're going to stay with Governor Walker now for our next story. Governor Walker in the headlines, of course, quite a bit as he's running for president. And earlier this week, he was asked about border security with Canada, and his response surprised some people. What happened there?
So he was on Meet the Press on Sunday, and he was pressed by Chuck Todd asking him, because he's been a big advocate for a wall on the Mexican border and tight border security, he was asked if we need a northern a wall to our north. And he said that someone in New Hampshire had brought it up to him and that that's a legitimate issue for us to look at. It was a passing comment, drew a lot of attention. He has tried to back off from it a bit in saying that that the media is making too much of this, that what he was trying to say is that we need more security. We need to, you know, watch security issues on our northern border as well. But the phrase that he used was legitimate issue to look at building a wall. It's clear now that he does not want to actually build that wall.
Well, as you said, that got a big response when it was seen as a proposal that he was going to stand behind. What sort of things did people have to say?
Well, I talked to one Republican in Iowa, which is obviously an important state, who said, you know, running for president is something where you have to be very disciplined about. And as he put it, talking about building a wall between here and Canada is not disciplined. That's crazy talk. So I think it's hurt him with some people who think that he's not putting forward responsible positions, or that he's saying things and then having to back off from them. It's been a rough few weeks for him in the presidential campaign when he was, you know, soaring high sort of in the earlier days, in the earlier months of the campaign.
We're talking with Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the biggest stories in Wisconsin this week. And we'll stick with Governor Walker also for some other comments that made the news. The governor had written a column, and he had tied anti-police rhetoric to President Obama. What did the president say, and what was the reaction?
Well, this is kind of got the responses that you might expect. Some Republicans in the base have been very supportive of his comments. They feel that the Black Lives Matter movement has turned into this sort of anti-police sentiment, and the governor was tapping into some anger about how officers are portrayed, saying the vast number of officers are good, they're here to protect us, they're doing the right things, and that he feels this anti-police sentiment has developed, he said, developed under the president. That is not going over well with the president or many Democrats, who say that the governor can't be blaming the first African American president in the country's history for inflaming racial tensions.
And finally, the state assembly debated the merits of a couple bills that would take federal funding away from Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin, as we know it. What do we know about these bills?
So Republicans have controlled the state house for about 5 years, and early in Governor Walker's time in office, they took away state funding for Planned Parenthood. Now they're trying, the state gets some federal money that's passed on to Planned Parenthood still, and they're trying to find ways to restrain that, and so they have a bill that would redirect that money to providers who do not provide abortions. Now the money that Planned Parenthood gets from the government can't be used for abortions, but opponents are concerned that it sort of offsets other costs they might have and frees up money so that they can provide abortions. This is an attempt to prevent that from happening.
And we leave it there. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, giving us the latest on the top news stories happening in Wisconsin this week.
We continue with the final installment of our new summer music series, Set List. We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which have aired every Friday at this time.
Eric Caldera grew up in San Antonio, Texas, before calling Madison home. He moved to Madison to attend the UW, pursuing a doctorate studying the genetic disposition of Central American ants. And along the way, he formed the instrumental rock trio, El Valiente.
We recently interviewed the band here at the WPR studio. So any fun / horrible stories to share from touring? Always, it seems like every band has the something that lives on in legend.
Yeah, we don't really do the whole rock star thing. I don't know that we have anything crazy. We had brake problems in Iowa.
El Valiente, thanks a lot for joining us here in Buck Studio.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Big fan of the show.
Well, I always like to ask about the origin story of the band. How did you guys meet and start playing together?
We formed back in 2006. I had just moved up here for grad school from Texas, and nothing too exciting. I put out a Craigslist ad, and I said, here's what I'm kind of trying to do, and Joe here answered the ad. Our bass player at the time answered the ad as well, and we all kind of got in the same room together for the first time, and it was pretty instantaneously. I think we all knew we were going to kind of stick together.
Now, Eric, you're up here from San Antonio originally, as I understand?
Sure, yeah. I grew up in San Antonio, went to school in Austin, and then moved up here for graduate school. Yeah.
And tell me about your first guitar.
My first guitar, I actually got at the pawn shop that was kind of near my house. And when I first sort of got into playing rock music and wanting to play the guitar, I was hanging out with some metalheads, and they were kind of loaning me their guitars, and my parents really didn't like that very much, so they didn't want me playing the guitar. So for
bad,
I think
bad crowd, man.
Yeah, yeah. So I was growing my hair, you know, doing all the wrong things, and so I started saving my lunch money. Actually, I wasn't eating at school, so I would save my dollar a day, and then I would stop by the pawn shop that was near my house, and I knew that the cheapest electric guitar there was $40. So once I had my $40 that I saved up, I went and just kind of bought it on the way home from school.
So you went hungry for 40 days.
Yeah.
That was almost like religious.
I did
40
not
days
even
of
think about that until now. Yeah. Yeah.
How old were you?
I was in 8th grade, so I was, I think, 13. Yeah.
You learned on the street, you taught yourself. How did that work?
Yeah, I kind of taught myself and just, you know, hanging out with friends, teaching me riffs and showing me songs. Unlike Joe, I don't really have a lot of experience with theory or really know kind of the notes, the names of the notes or the keys that I'm in. I'm just kind of feeling things out. And Joe is really helpful because he's often a good translator when, like, Chris is like, what chord is that? What note is that? And I'm like, I just kind of show Joe and he says, okay, he's playing an A or this or that, so...
So, Joe, you must be more than a drummer if you're translating the chords back and forth. I mean, not that you could be more than a drummer. I mean, that's the pinnacle. But
it is.
In addition to being a drummer, you're other things.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a background in theory for sure.
Let's give the bass player a little love, Chris. Can you get over to the mic there a little bit? When did you... Now, you weren't the original bass player. Well, how did you get into the band?
Well, the original bass player went off to a PhD program.
I think he's spinning around a Hadron Collider. Right,
some
now.
Highly intellectual musicianship here, yeah.
So I'd played shows with these guys in another band I was in previously, National Beekeeper Society, and they contacted me and asked if I'd like to join El Valiente.
What's the learning curve like that for these, you know, 7 to 9 minute... carefully crafted.
The first song I tried was a 14-minute song called Curandera, and I was, it was a lot of fun and a lot of work to learn their material, but it's been really fun to be in this band and play this different kind of music.
Well, I'll get more into your music in a bit, but I got to ask the cliche question, ask every band, what's been the influence of Central American ants on the music of El Valiente?
So I... for my graduate work, I've studied some obscure ants in Central and South America. So I've just always loved the little buggers. We named our second album and the title track, which we played just now, Dasaton, which is a group of ants that have big, gnarly trap jaws, and they have these big mandibles. So we just, you know, even their little guys, they're really tough. So I thought that was appropriate for our music.
And are you thinking about these Dasaton ants as you're composing this, as you're playing it?
Yes and no. Sometimes I actually, when I've done field work in the past, I've taken a little acoustic guitar with me, and so often I'm writing some of the riffs that we use while I'm kind of just sitting around with my acoustic guitar.
Joe, is it ever like, okay, the ants are cool, Eric, but enough with the ants already today?
it really doesn't. It's not that pervasive.
Okay. Now, when I think of instrumental music, a lot of times I think of, okay, short poppy stuff like The Ventures or Shadowy Man on a Shadowy Planet, or I think of like a jam band where they just kind of meander for 10 minutes to 2 days or whatever. Seems like you guys are neither. This felt like, when I'm listening to you, it feels like these are composed epic instrumental pieces.
Thank you. I think we do try to have structure, and I think when we started the band, that was a goal. You know, we... just kind of let the song write itself in some ways, not trying to force anything too much.
Do you start playing one thing and then over, I don't know, many rehearsals, it evolves into the final form? Or is there ever a final form?
We write glacially slow. I mean, and we throw out a fair number of ideas along the way, too. So I think one of the goals was that we always wanted it to be instrumental, but not feel like it was missing vocals at any point.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you ever Frankenstein things? Like, oh, there's this bit that didn't work in this one song, but totally. It's really good. It's got to go somewhere. Yep. It's looking for a home.
We do that a lot. Yeah, we just take chunks and kind of just put them in the back pocket and say, that's awesome, but it's not working with the song right now, so we just keep it in the pocket.
Now, you mentioned Dacetom is the name of one of the songs you're playing today, about the ant. Your latest album is White Comanche. I did a little interweb research. Yeah. The only thing I could find is a Western starring William Shatner, his twins.
You got it.
Yeah.
Is that really the spirit of El Valiente there?
Totally.
Yeah. In some ways, I think we feel like our music a little bit, you know, could be soundtracks to, you know, some kind of Western escapes. And our first album was called El Topo, which is also kind of, I don't know, how would you describe
the
movie?
Cult film, Jodorowsky cult film.
Playing live versus in the studio, given, you know, longer instrumentals, but as you guys mentioned, they're composed. Mm-hmm. Is there much difference between a live show and what you end up doing in the studio?
There really isn't. We try to sort of have them be the same experience. When we do go in the studio and record, we don't track anything. It's all live. It's all, you know, we basically play the song a couple times and take the best cut. And that's kind of how we've recorded our albums, really fast and just try not to mess up too much and get a clean cut.
So you're all doing it, trying to do it all in one take.
Yep.
Elaborate songs where in some cases there's a unison part, an extended unison part between two of you.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound easy.
No. It gets the nerves going for sure. But we're sort of dedicated to it, I think.
Yeah. I will say I listened to Dacetone and I heard the, was that Glockenspiel? I get my marimbas and Glockenspiels and xylophones all mixed up.
Yep, you and most of the world.
Right,
yeah.
And I assumed, okay, you guys played it and then went back and dubbed in. And now I just saw you and you're doing this, like, I don't know, Shaolin Kung Fu technique where you're playing the drums and the Glockenspiel at the same time. How hard is that to do? That looks impossible to me.
It's really... I'm sure it looks harder than it actually is. I kind of just think of it as being part of the drum set at this point. So, you know, just like you might hit another cymbal or another drum, you know, you've just got these, you know, three octaves of metal bars.
So as long as you can hit it with a stick, it fits in with the
rest
of the drum set.
I do have some kind of quick mallet changes and things like that. But, yeah, that's how I think of it.
You sing in another band.
Yeah.
Is it nice to compartmentalize? Like, over here, I'm instrumentalist. Over here, I'm a singer.
It really is. It's great. I feel like I can do whatever I want in terms of writing. If I feel like just writing kind of a folk song, I can do that. And sometimes I write a guitar riff that I really like, and I can't sing over it or can't figure out how to sing over it. So I'm like, okay, I'll put this in the pocket and maybe I'll throw this out at El Valiente practice.
Was it Frank Zappa had a multi-album set, Shut Up and Play Your Guitar? So it's El Valiente, your Shut Up and Play Your Guitar project?
Yeah, exactly.
What is being a musician in Wisconsin like compared to San Antonio, Texas?
To be honest, I think in terms of what we're doing here with El Valiente, I've found Madison to be incredibly receptive, more receptive than I imagined. So, you know, we're kind of weird and out there, but people seem to be really into it. I thought with this band we'd be sort of like an arty band, you know, kind of on the fringes, but the bar crowd seems to really dig us, so we really enjoy that scene. I think the scene in San Antonio, every time I go back, is expanding more and getting better and better. But when I was kind of there in high school, it was really dominated, I think, by like a lot of heavier punk and metal and kind of doing indie rock and kind of out there stuff was a little bit, you know, more on the fringe, I think, than it is kind of in Madison.
El Valiente, thanks a lot for coming to the studio and playing for us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
That was Madison instrumental rock trio El Valiente. You can catch them live September 25th at Mickey's Tavern in Madison.
This episode concludes the Setlist Summer Series here on Central Time, but the Setlist website will be continually updated with new content until the series returns next summer. Just head over to wpr.org/setlist to discover your next favorite band.
Coming up, nearly a million veterans have pending applications for care at the VA, according to a new investigation released yesterday. We'll hear the latest on veterans' health care after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. More than a year after original reports that at least 40 veterans died while waiting for care at Phoenix, Arizona's Veterans Health Facilities, the Department of Veterans Affairs is still the center of controversy. Yesterday, the VA's Inspector General released a report showing that nearly 900,000 veterans have pending applications for health care, of which 300,000 may have already died, although it's hard to tell because of flawed record keeping.
This week, we also saw a new development in Wisconsin's own Toma VA Medical Center scandal. The director of that center was fired Wednesday after a whistleblower revealed back in January that the center was over-prescribing painkillers and intimidating and retaliating against employees who spoke out.
Here with us now to talk about the latest news out of the Toma VA is Donovan Slack, USA Today Washington Bureau reporter. And coming up, we'll also speak with a Washington Post reporter about the new national report on the backlog of pending applications. Donovan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So did the VA share any specifics about why the Toma VA director was let go?
No, they didn't. They're being quite tight-lipped about the whole thing. In fact, they will only say that he was, quote, separated, although the VA has told members of Congress from Wisconsin that he was, in fact, let go.
Do you expect to see more information released, or is this kind of secrecy par for the course?
I think with everything in this story, it is going to be a continuous drip, drip, drip of the facts as we learn them mainly from whistleblowers.
Now, what exactly were the allegations of misconduct at the Toma VA Medical Center?
Well, I mean, you had an Inspector General investigation, and they found an overprescription of opiates at the facility. And earlier this year, a VA investigation also found that there was a fear of retaliation among staff members, which made them too scared to bring up problems. And I think this is where the director may have gotten caught out.
And beyond that, that culture of maybe fear for whistleblowers or having employees who were tentative about speaking out, is there anything we know that would indicate that the director was responsible for some of what happened at the VA center?
Well, I mean, I think any time you find this level of dysfunction, I mean, we should mention 35-year-old Marine Corps veteran Jason Simkuski died as an inpatient last August from mixed drug toxicity, which is the very overprescription of opiates that inspectors found there. Anytime you find that kind of dysfunction, the buck is always going to stop with the director.
It took a year for this to happen. Any idea why, if that was the case, it's taken a year?
Well, in this particular case, this scandal did not become public until January, when the Center for Investigative Reporting really blew the whole thing open, so to speak. So, in fact, it has been 6 months or 9 months, as it were, but that's really short in federal government time standards.
And have there been any final conclusions as to what exactly happened there, the culpability, and why?
In fact, we are still waiting word for what is going to happen to the chief of staff at the Toma VA, whom veterans had nicknamed the Candyman. and who actually approved the additional opiate said to have killed that Marine last year. He is still on reassignment, and I was told today by the VA that administrative, action against him is still, quote, ongoing.
So now that the director of the Tomo VA has been let go, do you consider this sort of a mark of closure for this episode, or is there going to be a lot to continue the investigation?
I think there's still a lot to come. Besides what happened with the chief of staff, I think that we're expecting more congressional hearings here in Washington that actually have to do with Tomo. Next month, I know Senator Johnson is convening one. I think there will be others, possibly about opiates. It's important to understand that what happened in Wisconsin is rippling across the nation when it comes to opiate prescriptions and other harmful practices.
And Donovan, what do you know about the latest in efforts to ameliorate some of these problems and find the causes and cures?
Goodness, you've got me there. The VA is the largest agency as outside of the military. I think there's 300,000 employees. There is always going to be issues, and the VA has pledged to fix each one individually. As far as the overprescription problem, they've issued new standards. They're trying to roll out new tools so doctors and nurses who are treating vets can gauge whether they are over-prescribing or not, and there's supposed to be better controls in place to make sure that they don't.
Have we heard any reaction from veterans themselves?
The veterans, I'm hearing a lot more from whistleblowers than I am from veterans, quite frankly.
Well, Donovan, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was USA Today reporter Donovan Slack talking about the firing of the Tomo VA Medical Center director on Wednesday. And now Emily Wax Thibodeau joins us. She's national staff writer at The Washington Post, and we'll be talking about an investigation released yesterday showing a backlog of applications for VA care nationally. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Happy Labor Day.
And to you. So tell us, what are the main findings from this new report?
Well, the most shocking finding, whistleblowers, they've been pointing this out for months on end now, is that the data system is not accurate enough to keep track and purge people who have died, and veterans who no longer need care but are still on the list. So it's a very confusing, by the VA's own words, system, and it's sort of just another, problem in a vending machine of woes that the VA seems to have.
So when the VA says that the system is confusing, is that a remark on the technology that they're using or something else?
I think so. They have pledged to streamline their system. Keep in mind that the VA was a paper system for decades. You would go to warehouses filled with records of veterans. Nobody was online. The new benefits administrator, Allison Hickey, actually was the first person several years ago to put everything online. So this is a fairly new shot at all the software to keep everyone updated. But it's just a credibility question. A lot of veterans are very perplexed that they're not getting their information quickly enough, that the lists are, the numbers are so high, yet people are already dead.
Right, that 900,000 figure seems to indicate that people who are still waiting for care right now who aren't getting it. So that's the accurate number, 900,000?
Yes, but 300,000 are thought to have already died. Another complicated part of this is that people sometimes, veterans sometimes apply to get appointments, but then end up going elsewhere. So they also haven't developed a computer system yet that is able to cull this information. Another whistleblower from Atlanta pointed out another glitch in the system, which is that combat veterans are supposed to get their benefits right away and not be judged by their income. However, the computer glitch was putting them on a waiting list and judging them by their income. And these are recent Iraq and Afghanistan combat veterans. So this whistleblower had brought this to the attention of the IG and is also awaiting a statement about that.
So when you say the combat veterans are supposed to get their benefits right away, do you mean that if they need to get in for medical care, they're supposed to jump to the front of the list and get seen right away?
Not necessarily jump to the front of the list, but there are certain criteria that the VA has to get you treated. Often it includes your income and whether you have private insurance. But if you're a combat veteran and, for instance, an amputee, you're supposed to not have to submit that information, but they actually, in fact, are making people. So the VA has, by its own admission, a lot of work to do in fixing the computer problems.
Now, you mentioned that it may be that 300,000 of that 900,000 on the waiting list may have already passed away. Is there any way of knowing whether the wait contributed to their death?
That's a tricky question and one that nobody has an answer to. It's very possible that some have and some haven't. No one's sure. And even the IG's report, the investigation said they have no way of knowing. There's unreliable data. It's all a big mess.
What has the VA said about why they're unable to purge the deceased from their list?
They say they don't have the right software. They say they're working on it and that this is a priority for them. And I know that Secretary McDonald has pledged to streamline their computer systems. He often talks about how there's 14 different websites with 14 different passwords, and veterans get very overwhelmed even trying to access the most basic services. People with PTSD, you know, can barely keep track of all of this as it is. So he's made it one of his goals. He's been in his position for a year now, and I think they're still trying to sort it out.
We're speaking right now with Emily Wax Thibodeau, National Staff Writer at The Washington Post, covering veterans and veterans affairs, talking about a new VA investigation out yesterday. According to that report, nearly 900,000 veterans have pending applications for health care.
We'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Maybe you have an experience that can help tell this story. Have you or someone in your family sought health care at a VA facility, maybe in the last year, and for better or worse, what was your experience? And if you work at a VA facility, have you witnessed a long wait times for veterans? What's the system like? Is it working where you work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Emily Wax Thibodeau, National Staff Writer at The Washington Post. We're talking about a new VA investigation out yesterday, finding faulty record keeping and long waiting lists for care.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you or maybe someone in your family sought care at a VA facility? How did it work out? Good experience, bad experience? If you work at a VA facility, what are things like at your work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have Chris with us in Janesville. Chris, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you. What is your experience?
I had a pretty good experience with the VA. Once I got in the system, it took me about a year to get myself into their computers or get myself into the system. But once I did, the care has been phenomenal. It's been really good.
Okay, so
I understand it. Not everybody has the same experience, but my experience has been pretty good with the VA so far.
Okay, so good experience. You said, though, what did you say, it took a year to get into the system?
Yeah, when I registered, and this was in the state of Oregon, but when I registered originally, I guess my paperwork went into one computer system and it didn't register with the other computer system, so I never got my first visit, initiation visit for a little over a year. And I had to go back and actually apply the second time to get the ball rolling. But once it was rolling, they did pretty good.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for calling and sharing your experience with us. Appreciate that. And Emily, what do you think about the story like that? The wait is a long time getting into the system difficult, but once there, the care he found quite good. Emily, are you with us? And I think we have lost Emily, and we're going to go next. We've got a couple more callers. Let's hear what you've got to say. We've got Brian joining us next at the Toma VA. Brian, hello.
How you doing?
Good, thank you.
My comment is basically I've been in the VA and inpatient now for almost 2.5 months. And like the last caller, it is absolutely phenomenal. The only problem I'm seeing right now is that because they're under the microscope so much that their decision-making process has been limited or they're afraid to make a decision. So no help is better than helping too much. And as far as the doctors that issue all this opiates, I don't know the full story on it.
Mm-hmm.
They're darned if they do and they're darned if they don't. You know, if this individual is really serious and complaining, and all of a sudden, you know, the doctor says, no, we've been issuing too much of that. Sorry, pal. And, you know, after that, you know, he's hurting so much. And then you got other people that may, you know, be abusing the system. But it's the individual that's abusing it, not the doctors.
So, Brian.
Doctors can only believe exactly what they're told.
Brian, you're describing part of what you said there was that it sounds as though the culture there, people afraid to, kind of walking on eggshells with the decision-making there. Is that affecting the care as you're experiencing it?
I wouldn't say it's affecting it, but it definitely slows it down a little bit because now they're so scared, afraid to make a decision that, you know, they got to check with three other people before they do it.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Appreciate that perspective as we talk about this right now, talking about news about long waits at in the VA system and the release or the letting go of the director at the Tomah VA recently as well. And we're going to go next to Ed in Wisconsin. Ed, hi.
Hi. Yeah, been in the military for about 19 years now, and over the years, I've developed pretty bad back issues. I've had to, I strictly go to the VA, just financially viable for me.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've been asking my VA doctor for something, either physical therapy or chiropractic, anything. Finally, after a year and a half, I was able to, talk him into it, is the best way of putting it, so I can move forward. I have a hard time standing for longer than a half hour, this kind of thing.
And Ed, do you think if you had gotten that okay sooner that your quality of life would have been better?
Oh, by far, yes.
Or do you appreciate the caution?
Sorry?
Or do you appreciate the caution that your doctor saw?
I will find out. I've had one appointment so far with my physical therapist.
Okay. Well, good luck to you. I appreciate you calling Ed and telling us about your experience. Time for another call. We've got Eric next in Fifield. Eric, hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. What's your story?
Well, I was in Desert Storm. I was with 82nd Airborne. And when we got out, there is something called Soddy Syndrome, where there is a bunch of us getting sick, and they weren't sure what was going on or what was causing us getting sick. And I had knee surgery shortly after getting out down at the VA Center in Milwaukee. And after that, I was in Iron Mountain. I went to the VA Hospital in Madison. And I started breaking out in random rashes that would cover like my entire half of my body. And I had gone down to Madison, and I basically got interrogated for like a half hour. And the doctor determined that I was allergic to a dog that I didn't have until 4 months after I was breaking out in these hives. And when I questioned him on that, he actually said that my body was just preparing to get allergic to this dog that I had no idea I was going to be adopting from a shelter. And that was the last time I went to a VA center. That was in the 90s.
Eric, thank you. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I really appreciate you calling and sharing your experience. So important to get the voices of veterans in on this issue. And thanks to everyone for calling as we talk about a new VA investigation out yesterday finding faulty record keeping and long lists for care for veterans.